Arizona's almost $63 billion short for meeting its transportation needs. But can lawmakers deal with that while also focusing on K-12 education?
I think the focus of the legislature and the governor right now is to have a special session and get that resolved and try to get that behind us first before I think we can go to the next big topic.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Maricopa County is expanding its behavioral health crisis system, plus creating a statewide bike path.
And reading from the outhouses of the Old West.
The main thing was that the catalogs were used as their form of toilet paper. Sears was considered the best catalog for this purpose.
Plus, Southern Arizona gets some new hotshots and marketing nostalgia.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our forecast high for today was 93 degrees. Magically at 204, it's already 94, so we've passed that. But look for clear skies tonight with lows in the mid-70s. Quickly in valley traffic, fairly serious accident in the East Valley. It's the 60 eastbound at Higley Road, and it's blocking the right lane.
A Northern Arizona University student is accused of fatally shooting another student and wounding three others in an early morning shooting in Flagstaff. KJZZ's Laurel Morales joins me with more on this. And Laurel, what do we know about what happened this morning?
So the NAU Police Department was notified that shots were heard at 1:20 in the morning. They responded so quickly. They got there at 1:22. Little is known about what happened between in those following minutes, but they say at 1:22, the suspect was detained and the situation was secured. So this all took place outside a residence hall. It's called Mountain View Residence Hall. It's where a lot of sorority and fraternity members live on campus. And we know that those involved, there were two groups fighting when the suspect pulled a gun, and that some of those involved were members of the Delta Chi fraternity.
Do we know anything about either the suspected shooter or the victims in this case?
The suspected shooter, his name is Stephen Jones, and he's a freshman and not a member of a fraternity. He has been charged with one count of first-degree murder and three counts of aggravated assault. The young man who died, his name is Colin Brow. He's from Castle Rock, Colorado. That's about 30 miles outside of Denver. He was a lifeguard here in Flagstaff. All four, the three wounded and the young man who died, were members of the Delta Chi fraternity.
Laurel, you were on campus at NAU earlier today. What's the mood like there?
Yeah, at about 7:30 this morning, students were on their way to class. Many were surprised that it was not on lockdown, but as the NAU police said, this was an isolated incident, not a mass shooting like what occurred in Oregon just days ago. One student I spoke with who was really surprised that this could happen in a town like Flagstaff.
I mean, NAU is probably one of the last colleges I thought it would happen at. The town itself, I mean, and the students, people, everyone seems very friendly.
That was Spencer Erdman, a senior. He's 22, on his way to class.
That's KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff talking about the shooting earlier this morning at NAU. Laurel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Arizona's Secretary of State's office has seen some election-related controversy in recent months, with some activists wanting the office to try to do more about so-called dark money and what entities are contributing to political campaigns. But in a new package of proposals, the Secretary of State doesn't directly address that issue. Instead, the focus is on simplifying many aspects of campaign finance law in Arizona. Eric Spencer is the state elections director who works under Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. Eric, what's the aim of these proposals?
Well, the main goal is to make campaign finance usable for the common citizen. It really shouldn't require a lawyer to engage in your First Amendment rights. And because of the accretion of statutes piled upon other statutes, which are not only ambiguous but also contradictory in many ways, the common citizen really can't access it without getting an expert. And that's just not good for democracy. So the biggest goal of our complete overhaul is to reorganize the law, start from scratch. Let's think about what we need and build from there.
We're talking about over 1,000 pages of material currently, right, related to campaign finance in some form. If it was just really a matter of cleaning things up, why did we let it get to this point?
Well, I think a lot of what the legislature does by inertia is to regulate according to some sort of controversy that's come up or some hole in a particular statute, and then you just plug that particular leak. We're proposing something rather bold, which is let's scrap the entire chapter of the law and substitute it completely with something new. I think a lot of people in the lobbying community would pause at doing something that ambitious because it's a pass or fail test. The whole thing has got to be enacted. Of course, the legislature will tinker with some of the policy decisions within it, but you can't just enact part of this infrastructure. You've got to do the entire thing. So I think out of fear of failure, a lot of people would hesitate to be this bold in a legislative attempt, but we're not here to just occupy the office. We're here to make real change. So if it fails, it fails, but we're confident that it's so well thought out and so nonpartisan that it will go through next year.
One of the proposals would reduce the number of political committees that can be filed for election activities down to 3. What difference is that going to make?
We're collapsing 9 committees into 3, but we don't lose any disclosure through that at all because the campaign finance system will still capture all of those transactions. So whether you're giving money directly to a candidate or you're spending money independently of a candidate or you're spending money in a ballot measure, all of those financial inputs will be put into the new campaign finance web system and you'll be able to see it better than you ever have before. And it's going to include cities, towns, counties, special districts. So for the first time in history, you'll have every single jurisdiction in Arizona reporting all of this data into one place, and it'll give the political consumer more tools to them than they've ever had.
And quarterly finance reports, even in non-election years. Why is that important? Is that something that, and are the rules going to be understandable enough that even as people more frequently and committees more frequently have to file, they'll be able to understand it more readily?
Yes. I mean, currently there's an entire, every other year, there's an entire year without any campaign finance data. You report in late December of an even numbered year, the entire odd numbered year you're off, and then you file one in January. So that's a 14-month gap in reporting. We want to switch to a quarterly system where the reports are going to come in 4 times a year, both odd and even numbered years. We think that's a very workable system for even the common political consumer to understand. And you don't have to be an expert treasurer to know when all those deadlines are. It's every single quarter, and those quarters are on the same time period as federal candidates report. The federal community is already used to that quarterly reporting system. So we think this provides more transparency, more certainty, easier to comply with.
One other proposal would get rid of the requirement that independent expenditure groups notify another group they've attacked within 24 hours. That seems like it could take away an important form of disclosure.
There's a statute that was enacted back in the early 1990s after ASCAM that was intended to be a well-meaning reform, but it was struck down on constitutional grounds later in 2003. In essence, this statute requires any outside group that's attacking a candidate to send a copy of that advertisement to the candidate within 24 hours by certified mail. This was a technologically speedy method back when the law was written in 1993. But in 2015, when candidates already know about the ad that attacked them because it's on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, not to mention television, and what didn't exist in 93 is email. So there are all kinds of different ways that candidates can be provided this notice, and frankly, candidates already know that they've been attacked before that certified letter hits their doorstep anyways.
Eric Spencer is Arizona's state elections director.
The Arizona Transportation Department is facing a more than $60 billion shortfall between projected transportation needs and available funding. That's the analysis from the State Office of the Auditor General. Jeremy Weber is a performance audit manager with the Office of Auditor General.
Overall, we reported that the legislature should consider creating a task force to study and propose options for addressing the state's transportation revenue needs. having sufficient transportation revenue is important for maintaining a safe, efficient, and cost-effective transportation system. The department uses various revenue sources to help plan, construct, and maintain the state's highways, bridges, and other aspects of the transportation system. However, according to the department's most recent long-term or long-range transportation plan, projected revenues fall short of anticipated needs. Specifically, the department estimated that it would need approximately $89 billion between fiscal years 2010 and 2035 to address expected deficiencies and to meet minimum standard conditions, acceptable conditions, such as pavement, bridge, and traffic congestion. However, the department estimates that only $26 billion in revenues would be available to the department to use for the state's highway system or the state's transportation system during that same time period, resulting in a shortfall of almost $63 billion.
So given the needs and given the available money that ADOT is dealing with, have you found or did the audit look at how the agency is prioritizing as far as maintaining or putting off new projects, anything like that?
The department did report that because of a lack of anticipated funding, this has affected their planning, specifically some of the timing and scope of state transportation projects. For example, projects have been delayed or postponed indefinitely. In addition, projects are now smaller in scope and less costly than in prior years. In addition, there's been an increased focus on preservation over expansion, specifically within rural areas of the state.
Are there different ways that the agency could try to alleviate this shortfall? I mean, we hear so much about raising the gas tax, for example. Are there other options that lawmakers could be looking at?
Yes. Specifically, we looked at what other states were doing or exploring to address transportation revenue needs in their states. And our report included several or highlighted several of these types of actions, including altering the fuel tax. For example, that could include either increasing the fuel tax, which in Arizona is a cents per gallon tax, or it could mean changing the tax to be a percentage of the gasoline sale. It could also be indexed to inflation to rise as inflation changes over time. In addition, some states have explored, in one state, Oregon, it has implemented a program to replace the fuel tax with a vehicle miles travel tax, which would impose a tax based on the miles traveled rather than on fuel consumption. Other options that we highlighted included creating toll roads and lanes, raising existing vehicle fees such as car registration fees and the vehicle license tax here in Arizona, creating alternative fuel vehicle fees or taxes on alternative fuels, and dedicating a portion of sales tax or general fund monies to transportation.
Jeremy Weber is a performance audit manager for the Arizona Office of the Auditor General. Jeremy, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Would lawmakers be open to any of those ideas? To find out, we turn to State Senator Bob Worsley of Mesa, who chairs the Senate Transportation Committee. And Senator, what do you make of the Auditor General's report?
Well, Mark, we've known that this gap has existed now since I've been in the Senate, and we haven't changed the gas tax since 1991. Further, our cars are getting more mileage. We have people driving hybrids and electric cars. And so the world's changed pretty much since then, and at some point here we need to address the way we collect gas tax or user fees for our highways.
Do you think there's the political will in the legislature to raise the gas tax?
I don't think that time is correct or time is right at this point. We are focused on K-12 education and getting the litigation settled with the Cave Creek lawsuit. It's a very large number, and I think the focus of the legislature and the governor right now is to have a special session and get that resolved and try to get that behind us first before I think we can go to the next big topic.
The Auditor General's report recommended that the legislature set up a task force to basically look at and eventually propose some funding options for transportation. Do you think that's a viable option?
Yes, and I think that precedes any action where you would educate everyone thoroughly on the issues. We need to go through a study process, and from that, I think we'll see some recommendations that probably not this next session, but maybe the following session can maybe lead to some recommendations for the lawmakers to consider.
Do you have any favorites in your mind of ways to fund some of these projects?
Well, I do think that there is a really unique opportunity to address this while gas prices are low, and something like using a sales tax versus just a cents per gallon tax that would give you the effect of having a way to be inflation adjusted if gas prices rise again. There's probably some user fees that would fix the problem we have with electric cars and hybrids that are getting lots of mileage but using the roads, like all the other cars that don't have that mileage. Maybe some type of VLT adjustment, vehicle license and registration type of fee adjustment for cars that are not buying gas, therefore they're not paying for the gas tax.
The funding gap identified by the Auditor General's report, nearly $63 billion, it just seems like such a big number, even within the scope of state government. Do you think that the proposals that you've mentioned can really close that gap?
No, I don't think so. It's just a really large number, and I don't think anyone wants to have a gas tax or a user fee that's really exorbitant. Personally, I think that we're going to see a number of mitigating factors that are going to come into play. Almost all of the automakers are looking at autonomous vehicles and using technology to allow people to not have to drive their car, which would allow us to put many, many, many more cars on the road in the same lanes and the same freeways that we have today. So some of these projections are based on today's technologies, today's cars. There may be a way to do things more cost-effectively in the future.
State Senator Bob Worsley of Mesa chairs the Senate Transportation Committee. Senator, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Still to come, resisting gentrification on Grand Avenue.
I don't want to be the next hotspot. I don't think that's a good thing to be the next hotspot because basically that attracts the wrong people who want to make money off of your neighborhood.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein checking Valley traffic. A cluster of accidents in the East Valley, the 60 eastbound at Val Vista, also at Greenfield. In both cases, the right lane is blocked. Also an accident on the 143 southbound at University and I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue. Valley weather for tonight, we expect fair skies and lows in the lower to mid-70s. It'll be sunny and well above normal tomorrow with highs in the upper 90s. Currently, relative humidity is at 21%, mostly sunny, 94 degrees at 221.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and a 100% online option. Details about the Tuesday, October 13th info session at ellerembA.com.
Maricopa County is increasing the capacity of its behavioral health crisis system. Some of this has already happened. Over the past few months, a new step down and adult respite facilities have opened. The rest should be open within the next 2 to 3 months. For more on this, I'm joined by Joel Conger, Crisis Services Director for Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care, and Jamie Pottis, Director of Utilization Management for Community Bridges, one of the groups involved in the expansion. Joel, what's the state of the system now?
We provide crisis services to the entire county, so that could be up to, you know, the 4 million people that reside here. And right now, I would say that, you know, we have an adequate availability of crisis services, but there are peaks and valleys in that demand that really have stretched our ability to provide timely intervention for folks who are in psychiatric crisis. So with these expansions, we're confident that through the avenues that we're pursuing, we're going to absolutely be able to better meet the need of Maricopa County in terms of having that emergency psychiatric services available.
Jamie, your organization is one of those that is part of this expansion. Tell me about what it is that you guys will be starting to do.
Yeah, so in the near future, we are going to be opening up, it's called CPEC, the Community Psychiatric Emergency Center, and that's located over in Mesa. It provides a variety of services. We've been open over there for a couple of years, providing voluntary crisis services and short-term residential services for folks. But we're currently opening up to also serve the involuntary patients. So we'll be able to do involuntary services for folks who have been petitioned by either their family members or PD. Also doing bridge scripting for folks who may need a short-term prescription to make them to their next doctor appointment. Also with a subacute inpatient psychiatric facility.
With that expansion, will that help you meet the need that you currently have, or will that help you sort of future-proof against future needs?
I think it'll do both. Right now, the East Valley doesn't have an involuntary provider, and this will meet that need.
Joel, overall, will the expanded services be able to meet future needs, or are they just sort of keeping up with the needs that maybe you haven't been able to meet up until now?
I think Jamie was right. It's going to do both. It's really going to help us better meet the current need, but also we're going to be much better suited for the future growth and subsequent need that will come with that.
Have you seen, in general, an increase in the demand for these services over the past year, 5 years, something like that?
Significant demand, yeah. Our system is definitely growing leaps and bounds, and trying to keep up with that needs has been a challenge. But really, the gains that we have made in the past year and that we're looking to make, you know, in the near future are going to go a long ways towards meeting those needs.
How did you decide where to put these new services, which organizations you're going to try to partner with to get new beds and other new services available?
Well, in terms of geography, the East Valley was very much underserved with urgent psychiatric care options, if you will. And that process was a rather extensive process.
Jamie, what do you think is the best case scenario from your organization's point of view once your new services are available?
I think one of the benefits of this new facility is that it's an integrated team approach. So we offer not only the psychiatric services there, but if someone's in there and has a medical need as well, we're able to meet that. So think of it as something that an urgent care could treat. It's probably something that we could treat while that person's in-house with us. So we don't have to send out everyone to the hospital or an ER for a minor medical issue, such as, you know, a urinary tract infection, pink eye, things like that. We can treat in-house.
So in theory, then, by expanding these behavioral health services, you also could take somewhat of a strain off of emergency rooms, doctor's offices, places like that.
Correct. And that's also something that the bridge scripting side does. So when someone runs out of a prescription or if they miss an appointment with their psychiatric provider, instead of them being out of a prescription for 2-3 weeks and kind of having that increase in symptoms, they're able to come to our facility and get a short-term script to make them till their next appointment.
Joel, from your perspective, what is the best case scenario outcome from all of this expansion?
The best case scenario is getting folks the right treatment at the right time. You know, right now, for folks who are in urgent psychiatric crisis, all too often we'll either end up in jail if, you know, there's an issue going on out in public, or in other instances, they'll end up in an acute emergency room, and neither which are the right settings for folks who are having behavioral health challenges. So best case scenario is we're going to provide yet another option for folks to come in and get actual psychiatric intervention if they're having behavioral health crisis, as opposed to, you know, law enforcement or an emergency room.
Do you think that with this expansion, the behavioral health system will be where it needs to be, or will there still be more work to do after this?
I think we still have work to do, but this is a huge step in the right direction.
Jamie, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a step in the right direction. I think there's always going to be changes. It's behavioral health, it's crisis, so we're always going to be willing to adapt to those changes.
Jamie Potist is the Director of Utilization Management for Community Bridges. We also heard from Joel Conger, Crisis Services Director for Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care. We are talking about the several million dollar expansion of Maricopa County's behavioral health crisis system.
The state of Arizona has received approval for its portion of a nationwide bicycle system. The American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials has signed off on a 573-mile-long east-west route that will run through the state from the California to New Mexico borders. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke to the official in charge of the project for Arizona.
Arizona wants to build on what it calls its reputation as a world-renowned destination for bicyclists. It also wants to cash in. An Arizona Department of Transportation study completed last year estimates that bicycle tourism generates more than $88 million annually in economic effect to state coffers. The designation of the Arizona portion of U.S. Bicycle Route 90 will not involve building new infrastructure. The route will follow existing state highways, local streets, and paths. I asked Arizona Department of Transportation Bicycle and Pedestrian Coordinator Michael Sanders to tell us more about the project.
Well, Bicycle Route 90 is part of an interstate bicycle route system. And here in Arizona, it connects the New Mexico border with the cities of Tucson, Phoenix, and then the California border. So what it does is directs bicyclists along a cross-state route that includes a variety of facilities, but they're all existing facilities. Could be a state highway, could be an off-road shared-use path within the Tucson and the Phoenix metro areas, which is the primary route in those large urban areas, is an off-road path system. And then, of course, local streets along the way.
This is a 573-mile route, which follows existing state highways and local streets and paths. What went into planning and design for this, and ultimately keeping people safe?
One of the tasks was to identify a set of criteria that we would use to evaluate alternative routes. You know, the scoring was based on things like what would be the most comfortable type of facility for a bicyclist. For example, the shared-use path that's off the highway, that's off the road. You know, particularly those that are grade separated in the major metro areas. But, you know, we have to get from point A to point B. And so, you know, we looked at alternative routes and made decisions about what would be the most appropriate for the cross-country or touring bicyclist.
Why is this so significant for Arizona that we have this now?
You know, a lot of it's related to the tourism industry. A couple of years ago, we had completed an economic impact study of bicycling in Arizona, specifically looking at the out-of-state bicyclists. So, you know, we did various surveys of organizations that that lead tours or that come to Arizona or are already here and set up tours for people to do bicycling in Arizona. You know, we also surveyed bike shops and other sources of information to come up with, you know, what is that impact that the out-of-state bicycle tourist has on our economy. So, you know, part of this is definitely related to that, to the tourism industry.
Michael Sanders is with the Arizona Department of Transportation on the approval for U.S. Bike Route 90, which will run across the state. Michael, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome, Phil. Thank you.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Coming up, a Valley orthodontist brings back a staple of Valley childhood.
We tried to preserve many of the original goodies and treats and prizes in the original LADMO bags. The goodies and treats are from local Arizona vendors.
A LADMO bag with goodies and toothpaste. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, the 60 eastbound has some trouble. At Val Vista, the right lanes are blocked due to a collision. At Greenfield, the right lane's blocked. Also, the on-ramp at Greenfield blocked. Best to avoid the 60 eastbound at this time. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon across the valley. Our forecast high was 93 degrees. Right now, it's 94 at KJZZ at 233.
KJZZ is supported by Retirement Income Specialist Winston P. Stevenson, working with retirees to build and protect their income for more than 30 years. October courses now open at Rio Salado North Campus. Details at winstonpstevenson.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama has met privately in Roseburg, Oregon, with relatives of victims and with survivors of last week's deadly shooting at a community college there. He spoke briefly to reporters afterward.
I've got some very strong feelings about this because when you talk to these families, you're reminded that this could be happening to your child, or your mom, or your dad, or your relative or your friend.
Obama says the U.S. needs to figure out how to stop such mass shootings from happening. 9 people were killed and 9 others wounded in the shootings at Roseburg. Several dozen demonstrators turned out there to protest Obama's call for tougher gun laws. Nearly 400,000 residents of Columbia, South Carolina, are still having to boil their drinking water as crews work to repair damage caused by last Sunday's downpours, which triggered flooding. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley says the floodwaters are receding, but she does not yet know when many of the people evacuated from their homes will be allowed to return.
The water's going to go down, and in some cases, 3 to 4 feet in a day, but there's a lot of water. So it just depends on when we're safe enough.
Preliminary estimates show that crop losses in South Carolina could total more than $300 million. There's been more violence today between Israelis and Palestinians. NPR's Emily Harris says the most deadly clashes occurred in the Gaza Strip. Health officials there say 6 Palestinians were killed.
Israeli soldiers just outside the barrier that surrounds the Gaza Strip apparently shot at Palestinians they say were throwing rocks and rolling burning tires toward the barrier. Elsewhere, Israeli police say a Jewish man stabbed 4 Arabs in an Israeli town, and Palestinians stabbed Israeli Jews in 3 attacks in 3 different towns. 1 Palestinian attacker was killed.
That's NPR's Emily Harris in Jerusalem. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 33 points today. This is NPR News from Washington.
In KJZZ News, a new herd of bison is coming to northern Arizona. KJZZ's Will Stone reports it's part of a national effort involving the state and several federal agencies.
By 2017, a new kind of bison, one with a rare genetic makeup, will roam a swath of protected habitat in northern Arizona. Recently, the Arizona Game and Fish Department inked an agreement that will replace the current bison herd at the Raymond Wildlife Area with a herd linked to Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. The agency says DNA testing has revealed that the bison currently under management in the wildlife area are the result of an unsuccessful crossbreeding of bison and cattle. In contrast, the Plains bison coming to Arizona are of a much purer breed and of value to the ongoing effort to preserve the iconic species. The state manages 2 bison herds, the other located at House Rock, east of the Kaibab Plateau. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Roosevelt Row this month was named one of the great places in America by the American Planning Association. It's the latest in a series of accolades for that Phoenix neighborhood. But when the awards roll in, rents can rise and price some residents out of the area. For more on this, we turn to Patricia Garcia Duarte, president and CEO of Trellis. The Phoenix nonprofit focuses on home ownership and neighborhood development.
We have learned over the history in housing, when you have too much concentration of one type, it really is not a good balance for neighborhoods and communities. In a community, it's also important to have a good balance between homeownership and renter percentages. In a community that doesn't have a good balance and affordability for housing, it really hurts the economy overall, not only the individual and the household. Someone that pays too much for housing, more than 30% for housing as a rule of thumb, really have more limitations and not enough discretionary income to help and make purchases. And so it has a compound effect when they can't spend money in other things to support the economy because it's all going into housing.
Why is it important for folks who maybe are in some of the middle or lower income brackets to be able to live in a place like Roosevelt Row?
It's important to have a good balance of different mixed incomes. If you think back in the 60s and 70s, it was very common to go into a neighborhood and the pharmacist lived next to the librarian, to, you know, all kinds of professions, service and hire. They were all mixed into a community. The way zoning, the planning into this new era really has segregated people by income levels, and they have proven not to be very healthy models overall for sustainability in communities.
In a neighborhood that is popular and keeps getting more popular and wins awards like this, how do you make sure that there are places for people who are not in the high rent district to live, that there is sort of a diversity of income levels, both in housing and in residence?
So there are, could be different programs that can be implemented. Trellis has worked in this space where we have different programs to help people fill the gap of affordability. So it could result in a down payment and closing cost assistance program. Generally, sometimes employers could realize the benefit of having affordable housing around their employment basis. So there's employer-assisted housing programs that are good models. Municipalities will use some of the federal funds or state funds to provide that gap in affordability. They can help developers develop affordable housing and have the right price rent that is affordable to low and moderate income people, or programs for homeownership. It's around city planning as well. Municipalities having an interest in creating that balance in housing.
Patricia Garcia Duarte is president and CEO of the Phoenix-based nonprofit Trellis.
Over the last 10 to 15 years, Grand Avenue has become a center of arts and culture in the city. But many would argue that it maintains a distinct difference from its counterpart, Roosevelt Row. And here with me to talk about that is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So what is happening on Grand Avenue?
Well, the part of Grand we're talking about is roughly from 7th Avenue to 19th Avenue. And most recently, Bragg's Factory Diner, which was a vegan restaurant, just closed down. And it was announced that Barrio Cafe, which is a pretty well-known, high-end, locally-owned Mexican restaurant, will be opening a second location there. And then you also might remember the Containers on Grand project, which are these shipping containers that were converted to apartments. Those are also going to be opening soon. So there was also an article in the New Times recently that makes the observation that Roosevelt Row has taken kind of a different trajectory than Grand Avenue. It's become a place that is recognized as trendy, and it's this urban core, and Grand Avenue is a little bit less developed. So I talked about this with Beatrice Moore. She's a really driving force on Grand Avenue, and she and her partner own several buildings, including the Bragg's Factory Diner building that will soon be occupied by Barrio Cafe. She actually said that there's an advantage to not being the next trendy part of town.
I don't want to be the next hot spot. I don't think that's a good thing to be the next hot spot, because basically that attracts the wrong people who want to make money off of your neighborhood. So sometimes it's okay to be like the unpopular kid. It's just like when you're in high school. Sometimes if you're the popular kid, you have to sort of give up some of your own ethics and your own who you are. And I think sometimes you just have to sit back and you have to go, you know what, it's okay not to be the next hot spot. As a matter of fact, you don't want to be the next hot spot, but we want to still be here in another 10, 15, 20 years and be a cohesive, healthy neighborhood that reflects diverse values and diverse, you know, economics and welcoming to lots of different kinds of people.
I think a lot about Grand Avenue and how 10 or 20 years ago, for a long time, that area was considered not particularly safe, and there weren't always a lot of interesting, creative, artistic things happening at night. And now it seems like there's so much more of that. But in an effort to have those things, the area has to maintain a certain kind of character. And so I sort of wonder how you can have lots of vibrancy and lots of businesses without it sort of turning into something that feels sterile.
Well, there is a very fine line between, once you clean up neighborhoods, then sometimes it attracts the wrong element. And to me, that wrong element are people who just want to come and speculate on the property, and they want to make a lot of money there. A lot of times they don't live there. But I think to have a healthy neighborhood that can survive some of the gentrification issues, and maybe it's not possible, I don't know, you can try for that sort of diversity in a neighborhood, but that means embracing lots of different things, including homeless, including social service agencies, including a mix of economic strata. If you don't embrace that, then you're going to get upscale people coming in and replacing the people that are already there. And that's what creates gentrification. And that's what makes these neighborhoods morph into something that becomes very slick, kind of false. You know, everything's new, everything's bright and shiny, everything's very clean. And they don't have much tolerance for the people that were in the neighborhood. Even the arts community is guilty of wanting to be surrounded by cool, hip things that ultimately are going to push them out, but they don't quite understand that correlation. And when that's what you want to be the predominant thing in a neighborhood, then you are going to get pushed out ultimately unless you have a lot of money.
So it sounds like for you, part of making sure that Grand Avenue retains its character and doesn't start looking like other places or doesn't become so trendy that people are pushed out of the area is not limiting the sort of more expensive or high-end projects that would be coming in, but also making sure that you keep services for people who are lower income and businesses that can serve a lower income population so that you maintain a diversity.
Yeah, I think you have to embrace those other projects, the lower income projects. And part of that is saying, yeah, we want affordable housing over here, because I know so many neighborhoods, they hear the word affordable housing, they think it's a dirty word. You know, it's like most of the people I know need affordable housing. A lot of the people in the arts community need affordable housing. So many people in the creative community need affordable housing. Families, seniors, you know, people with disabilities, all those people need affordable housing. So to me, I've always hoped that, well, if we have a few drug treatment centers in the neighborhood, Teen Challenge, you know, Wayward Youth, that maybe they don't want to build their upscale, you know, projects too close to those types of things.
Another thing Beatrice really emphasized is the importance of maintaining historic buildings as a way to build neighborhood character. Some of them are going to be on display actually next month as part of the Grand Avenue Festival.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
For a lot of us, the idea of using an outhouse for our personal business is not at the top of the list of things we want to do. Indoor plumbing was a great technological advance. But Professor Richard Melzer of the University of New Mexico, Valencia, has researched the importance of outhouses in telling some of the history of the Old West and Southwest life. Professor Melzer, you had previously studied cemeteries in New Mexico. How did you move on to outhouses?
As I was going around the state, these rural areas especially, I found these outhouses, and I was just amazed at how many were still around. We estimate there's at least 12,000 in the state today.
Were people maintaining them because they realized their importance, or in some cases, were they just forgotten about?
Very often they were forgotten about. Sometimes they still use them as backup systems and as quaint things to keep around, reminders of the past. People have great nostalgia for outhouses.
No, it's interesting because I think obviously the stereotype is that outhouses are used for a specific purpose, and yet people in the Old West times used them for multiple reasons. What were some of those other reasons?
Well, they certainly were social centers, if you believe it or not, because some people, especially if they had two holes in the outhouse, they could go out there and get some private space for conversations.
Wow, that's...
Sometimes people would go out to the outhouse just for privacy. Getting away from the large families and small houses. Unfortunately, some people went out to the outhouses for vices, including liquor. It's amazing how many thousands of bottles people find in old outhouses, in the holes. Some people went out to outhouses for reading. They read newspapers. Very often the outhouses would have newspapers to line the walls. We've seen Bibles in outhouses, calendars, and, of course, the ever-present catalogs. They were used for reading and it was sort of like their eBay, I guess, of their day.
Wow, that's incredible.
But the main thing was that the catalogs were used as their form of toilet paper. Sears was considered the best catalog for this purpose. It had yellow index paper that was just soft and the best. Montgomery Ward's was next, and last was Spiegel, the paper was considered way too hard.
I'm guessing too harsh. I'm guessing Sears wouldn't use that in their marketing campaign these days, right?
That's right, yes. But one woman wrote into Sears and asked for a new catalog, and they suggested that she buy toilet paper. They can order it from page 142. And she responded that if she still had page 142, she would need another catalog.
Were there still people who said, now, Richard, you're a historian. This is really what you want to study?
People do have fond memories of outhouses. It's so interesting to see. Not only the outhouses, but the pranks that went with them. You know, people, especially on Halloween, tossing them over.
Oh, God.
And wedging them shut so people couldn't get out. So they have good memories of the of this part of our past.
I guess that's a good memory for people who are not in the outhouse at the time, right?
Well, that's true.
I suppose if people could get past some aspect of outhouses in terms of the perception of them, are there lessons we can learn in terms of, I don't know, conservation?
Many people have that opinion today because of the use of water and resources in the facilities we use now. It's interesting. We think of outhouses as old and primitive, but in their day, they were considered modern and sanitary compared to what had been done in the past. So we're evolving, I guess, but some people still think that we could be more sanitary and make better use of resources.
Professor Richard Melzer of the University of New Mexico, Valencia.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. Tough to follow that, but in Valley traffic, 60 eastbound, the right lane's blocked at Val Vista and at Greenfield due to a collision. Also, the on-ramp at Greenfield is blocked. Elsewhere, I-10 eastbound, a collision at 7th Street has the HOV lane blocked. 94 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Gamage Beyond, presenting VJ Iyer and Mike Ladd in Holding It Down, the Veterans Dream Project, exploring the experiences of veterans of post-9/11 wars through their dreams, October 17th, ASUGamage.com.
It lured top names in the entertainment industry and was grand, upscale, and elegant. This famous Phoenix landmark was a true destination for the elite. Today, it's a little older, but still graces the downtown cityscape with charm and stature. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
The San Carlos Hotel was among the few places to stay in downtown Phoenix. During the 1920s, it was considered a luxury hotel. Did you know the San Carlos is one of a few remaining historic buildings in the area?
1927, it was constructed by Dwight Hurd, and he wanted the most expensive hotel in the whole valley, so he charged a dollar more, and he gave running ice water in every room and air-cooled environment here. So we charge a dollar more, like $3.50 a night.
Robert Malikian is a member of the family who owns the historical property and proudly walks me around.
Well, the most important thing to Mr. Hurd was fireproof. He was across the street, his office was, when the Adams burned down in 1910. So he knew the value of having a fireproof building. So he made this one. It's a poured concrete, reinforced concrete building.
Where the San Carlos stands now was actually the site of the first school ever built in Phoenix in the 1870s. It was demolished in 1919. When the San Carlos opened about 10 years later, it was a 7-floor building with 2 elevators. Each of its 144 rooms had circulating cold air and steam heat. Each even had its own bathroom. The building was designed Italian Renaissance style with marble flooring in the lobby.
Come on, let me cling on to you like a vine.
Make he catered to movie stars right from the beginning, because 1929 the Orpheum opens and Mae West comes here and tells Clark Gable, who was an unknown actor at the time, that there was a pretty nice place around the corner that you could walk and be anonymous.
Humphrey Bogart, Carol Lombard, Spencer Tracy, and big band performer Les Brown were just a few of the celebrities who stayed here. Some of the rooms bear the stars' names.
This is where Clark Gable would stay, right? And he'd watch right there. He'd have his food delivered to the room, and he'd sit at the window on his bed and just watch people outside.
A kiss on the hand may be quite controversial.
In the 1950s, a small wing and a swimming pool were added to the San Carlos. And around that time, Marilyn Monroe became a guest.
So here's where Marilyn Monroe stayed.
Her room on the third floor is the one closest to the swimming pool.
Because she liked to swim at all hours of the night.
And yes, it's named after her. The San Carlos still has most of its original decor and design. Even the 100-foot well that was dug for the school is still in place, down in the basement. Oh, if you want a full list of the Hollywood names who stayed here, check out their gold stars in the sidewalk outside.
Tiffany's.
It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something we should know, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
The Wallace and Ladmo Show was a bonding experience for many of us who grew up in the Valley anytime from the late 50s to the late 80s. It featured funny skits and humor that was targeted to kids and adults without talking down to any of them. The centerpiece of connection was the Ladmo bag, a simple brown sack that featured sweet surprises inside. Dr. Rishi Popat was one of the many who, myself included, were never lucky enough to win a Ladmo bag, what some have labeled the holy grail of kiddom. But Dr. Popat wants to give others the chance to win one at his Phoenix orthodontics office.
I grew up watching the Wallace and Ladmo Show every day before school, religiously. And after I finished residency and moved back to Phoenix and moved back home, I decided I wanted to embrace our community with something that's iconic to Arizona, that's iconic to our community.
Now, were you someone, I was someone who, I think I'm a little bit older than you are, but I was someone who never got a Ladmo bag. And even, there was even a play that was put on, and Pat McMahon was the guest there, and they gave away a Ladmo bag to someone in the audience, and I didn't win one either. Were you someone who ever got one?
I wish I always wanted one. I wanted a Ladmo bag ever since I was a kid. That's why I watch the show every day, just to see maybe I can get on the show one time and get a Ladmo bag. Even my parents did everything they could. We went to all the events on the weekends with Wallace and Ladmo at Peter Piper Pizza at Metro Center. We went to Encanto Park. When you really want one, your parents will do anything for it to get you whatever you want, kind of like a golden ticket. And so I never received one, and I was disappointed, and I was really saddened after Wallace died. And so it kind of thought to me, like, okay, look, let's try to bring back this tradition. Let's bring back the Ladmo bag. It brings generations together of people. It brings grandparents together with their children. It brings children closer to their kids who are having kids right now.
Don't give away all the secrets, but can you give us an idea of what's in the Ladmo bag?
The contents of a Ladmo bag has always been a mystery to me growing up. I've always researched. I wanted to see what was inside of it. I have friends who received Ladmo bags, and sometimes they would tell me, they wouldn't tell me. We tried to preserve as many of the original goodies and treats and prizes in the original Ladmo bags. The goodies and treats are from local Arizona vendors. So these are the retro candies, nostalgic candies that there was producing the bags in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And being an orthodontist, we also have to be mindful of the gummy and sticky and chewy and crunchy stuff that might pop off brackets. So we've also put a toothbrush in there and made it hygienic and clean for parents as well.
Orthodontist Dr. Rishi Popat paying tribute to an Arizona legend by bringing back Ladmo bags. Nostalgic marketing on a national level continues to expand too, as corporations from Geico to Honda are trying to appeal to our fond memories in getting us to buy their products. Robert Clara is an editor for Adweek magazine. Robert, what's a recent nostalgia-based ad that stands out for you?
Probably best known recently was the Geico. I don't know how they got salt and pepper back for this, but that retread was mighty amusing and also surprising for those of us who aren't really sure what the last 29 years went. Gatorade, too, has been, for their 50th anniversary, has been doing a lot of nostalgia stuff, specifically the Be Like Mike remix that they did,
sure,
which was hugely popular. And even late last year, Expedia did a spot that was called Find Your Nostalgia, and it featured home movies. And so a lot of brands are playing the nostalgia card these days, and they have been for a while. It's obviously a tactic that works, almost any time you trot it out. but there does seem to be quite a concentration of brands doing this in recent years.
Is there the feeling that nostalgia can work with those younger generations, maybe in part because of what some people at least construe as the world just moving faster, whether it's through social media and Twitter and Instagram, and things are just faster and faster, that millennials who didn't get a chance necessarily to go a little bit more slowly are thinking, oh, nostalgia, that's sort of a quaint idea that I haven't experienced even as a kid.
It raises the more esoteric question, can you get nostalgic for something that you don't remember? I think it's a legitimate point to raise, and I think that there is certainly a connection there that younger consumers that see an ad that references a time that they were not around for, but yet a time that strikes them as appealing because, you know, it looked cool, or it carries the suggestion that things were more leisurely back then. That can still be a very attractive message. And I think that there is really a sense of that across the board, not just with marketing. And it's not just a passing curiosity. I think that nostalgia is a very powerful emotion. And if it brings you to a place where you are lulled by the suggestion of a simpler, quainter time, then it doesn't matter if you were there or not.
When you have seen these ads, other than sort of hearkening back to a different time for you, has there really been that little switch in the back of you that says, you know what?
Yeah,
I think they get me.
I'm always wary, as I'm sure you are, of making a direct connection, because I don't really think that there's anything in the marketer's toolkit that's guaranteed to get a consumer to, you know, whip out the credit card. But I do think that we can say this much. It tends to put consumers in the kind of emotional place where they're more likely to spend money.
Robert Clara is an editor and reporter at Adweek magazine. He and I have been talking about nostalgia. Robert, thank you for allowing me to go back in the Wayback Machine. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Steve.
Plenty of good stuff to do this weekend. As always, you can check out Man of La Mancha this weekend. That's at Theater Works in Peoria.
If you like flaming cheese or just breaking plates, go to the Phoenix Greek Festival this weekend.
Also, David Sanborn will be performing tonight at MIM in Phoenix.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, Tiara Bayan, and Salt and Peppa. Sky Shatter and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Managing editor Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. All Things Considered is next on members-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.